Hi, this is Paul. One of my favorite times of year is when Justin Brierley gets his big conversations out. Well, this is only the second year he's been doing it, but I really like the long form video format that he uses for these. And I didn't click on this right when I saw it because it didn't look like it would have a lot of interest for me. But part of the beauty of having a YouTube channel for me has been I get signals from you when you find something that you say is really important. And so then I watch it. And there was an element of this conversation that I thought was simply outstanding, and I wanted to do some commentary on it.
Reality, the mental, the physical, the abstract, and
okay, so this is William Lane Craig and Roger Penrose.
In some sense, you actually believe there is more to this reality than simply the physical aspect, that many people, many of your atheist colleagues would say, well, that's all that ultimately exists here. Roger, do you want to just begin by sort of spelling that out, what your worldview is in that sense?
Well, you mentioned, what when you say my worldview, you mentioned the three worlds, which I often use to describe, like, these are things also, the three mysteries, if you like. Well, one of these, you say there's the physical world, you know, things like tables and so on, and what we think of as the physical world, or this. Not quite clear when we go deeply into what's going on, what that really means, but never mind about that. The physical world, and then there's the mental world, that's our experiences, consciousness, feelings about things, so on. And then there's what you call the abstract world. I would be more specific about that. It's a mathematical abstraction. So we're thinking about how it is that... Well, let me secondly explain the mysteries, you see.
Go ahead.
Mystery number one is the fact that this world of physics seems to depend so extraordinarily precisely, and the more we explore it, the more precise we see this is. It's so precisely guided by mathematical equations. So we have these mathematical, let's not just say equations, that
I don't know if they're guided by them, and William Lane Craig is going to get on this so much as we can use these mathematical equations to make predictions that are later verified by observation. That's at heart the scientific method and how we try to employ science, but the theoretical.
That's a bit too specific. Mathematical principles.
Yes.
Which govern in such a precise way the way this physical world operates. Mm. And there is, if you like, a huge mystery. I'm calling it a mystery. These things, we're never quite sure whether...
is this what Eugene Wigner famously spoke as the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics? It just seems to be an extraordinarily remarkable fact that mathematics, the universe seems to be written in that language and that we can discover it.
That's exactly it, yes. Mm. Yes. And the more we know about how things operate, I mean, now there's such extraordinary precision there are in measurements. Well, Einstein's general relativity is very, very precisely determined. And laws of quantum mechanics and how they interrelate with, even with gravity in some respects. I mean, how clocks, one of the Einstein's predictions is that a clock up high will run more slowly than one down here. Mm. And this precision in that, I'm sorry, I got it the wrong way around.
I know what you mean, yes. The precision is extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah. But the precision, you know, even from down here to maybe a centimeter above, and they can measure the difference.
Yes.
So these are extraordinarily precise. Now, it just shows that the mathematical theories, when we really understand them and when we get them right, they're still not quite right, that's clear. But nevertheless, the precision is extraordinary. So that's mystery number one. Mystery number two is, how is it that conscious experience can arise when the circumstances seem to be right? Now, it doesn't seem to be probably, I'm just guessing, but I don't think it's present in that glass or in the water in the glass.
And that gets into the panpsychism that we've come up with on the table. One of the interesting things is our intuitive sense of what's conscious and what isn't. Now, I think, in all honesty, we suspect that some things are and some things are not, But even to go into that question is a fairly interesting one, but I don't want to go too far into that.
But nevertheless, it seems to come about with human beings, and I think with other animals. I don't think it's unique to human beings.
Certain brain structures somehow seem to give rise to,
yes,
to this consciousness.
And there is a genuine mystery, I think, and it's not just a matter of complicated computations. There's something much more subtle going on. So that's mystery number two. And mystery number three is our ability to use our conscious understanding to comprehend mathematics and these very extraordinary, self-consistent but deep ideas, which are very far from our experiences. So that's how we comprehend mathematics, if you like.
And in that sense, you believe that mathematics, for instance, is discovered rather than invented by
Absolutely.
Us. In that sense, it exists
yes.
independently.
Yes,
of us.
Right. Yes.
Now I've been re-listening to Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris, What is Truth? And the more I listen to Sam Harris and other atheists like him, how often doesn't realism for many of them simply boil down to what psychologists call object permanence? That this is their main argument for a world external to our consciousness. And I'm not denying that or even denying the method of that, but that's a bit more complicated than it's usually just sort of offered up as.
And one of those great mysteries, as you say, is the fact that we can access it seems
yes.
itself a remarkable feat of reality.
That's right, because it's so indirectly connected with our existence and what, you know, how we get along in the world and how natural selection has helped us to survive and so on. It's really hard to see how these things come about from that.
There's three big mysteries there to kick us off with. Bill, what's your response to some of these huge?
So I'm going to use three M's for those mysteries. There's math, mind, and matter. Okay, so matter is the physical world. Mind is consciousness and all of that. And math. And I love how William Lane Craig addresses this. I think this is real brilliance.
Well, I want to say first and foremost that one of the most exciting things about Roger's thinking is this deep metaphysical vision of reality that he has. It's in such contrast to the sort of positivistic and verificationistic pronouncements of many scientists who think that philosophy is dead and that these metaphysical questions are meaningless. Mm. Roger is engaged in questions that are not simply physical or scientific. These are metaphysical questions. And I think that the fundamental issue that is raised by this tripartite metaphysics is the ancient philosophical problem of the one and the many. Mm. That is to say, what is the underlying unity of these three seemingly disparate realms of reality, the mental, the abstract, and the physical? These realms of reality are so different, so causally unconnected, it seems, that one wonders what is the underlying unity for all of these. So how are these three realms related? For example, the mathematical abstract realm cannot be the source of the physical or conscious mental realm, because abstract objects by definition are causally effete. That's part of what it means to be an abstract object. The number seven, for example, has no effect upon anything.
Now, well, he's going to get to this point in a minute.
So
make it.
The abstract realm cannot provide the source of unity. Could it be the physical realm that provides the source? Well, Roger's already mentioned the second mystery. How does the physical give rise to consciousness, particularly intentionality? The intentionality is the aboutness of our mental states. I can think about my summer vacation. No physical object has intentionality. So the mental is difficult to derive from the physical, and the abstract, it seems to me, is impossible.
Sorry, got interrupted. I'm going to back it up.
Well, Miss Kerouac, vacation. No physical object has intentionality. So the mental is difficult to derive from the physical, and the abstract, it seems to me, is impossible because the mathematical realm is characterized by necessity. These aren't logically necessary truths, and by its plenitude. There are infinite realms of mathematical objects. And the physical realm, by contrast, is contingent and therefore cannot ground these logical and mathematical truths. And it's plausibly finite as well. So the physical can't be the support. Now, what about the mental? Could the mental be the source of these other two realms? Well, in mental causation, we do have the experience of the mental causing physical changes in our brain. I can will to get up or to speak. Similarly, many philosophers have thought that the abstract realm is not really a separate realm that exists by itself, but they are ideas in the mind of consciousness that...
He really wanted to say God.
They deal really a separate realm that exists by itself, but they are ideas in the mind of consciousness that they are the result of intellection by a mind. Now, the problem is that no human mind could be the source of the abstract realm because of its plenitude and necessity. Where
not only its plenitude and necessity, but also its... I mentioned before that Sam Harris, when he... engages the physical world, and when he wants to create a system that it's based on the physical world, uses basically object permanence as his argument for that. Well, math is just as communal and theoretical permanent as the physical world, if not more so, and as William Lane Craig, also quite necessary. And so I love how this conversation developed right here. It's really fascinating.
We are contingent and finite. So what? Now, the problem is that no human mind could be the source of the abstract realm because of its plenitude and necessity, whereas we are contingent and finite. So what I want to invite Roger to comment on is, why couldn't the mental realm include an infinite consciousness? That is to say, an omniscient mind which has created the physical realm and which is the source of the abstract mathematical realm.
And the little mental realms that all of us run around with, and very much, if, you know, taking this further than William Lane Craig wants to take it here. Like I said before, a number of years ago, I was really thinking about writing a book. And it was very much about this. I didn't see the threeness of this, but the idea of resurrection and what exactly would we be, what exactly of us needed to be preserved and then resurrected and reunited with a body. And that would very much be the mind, and it would be very much connected with story and the story that you and I are. And so I think this is just a fascinating little interchange here. Oh, it's just phone and everything. I'm gonna let the phone go. It's usually nothing.
This would solve the problem of the one and the many and give you an underlying unity for this tripartite metaphysic that you affirm.
And what
now, of course, just the sort of setting for all of this. And some Christian might imagine, oh, now Roger Penrose is going to stand up and say, I believe, and, you know, and start going to church and get baptized and all of this stuff. And of course, that's not going to happen because that's not the way these things work. But that question of what do we want from Roger gets very interesting in where this goes from here. And not only is this little triple mind, matter, math question really fascinating, and William Lane Craig's observation that mind seems to be, of the three, the thing that can best manage matter and math, So, because mind colonizes matter all the time. So I argue in my definition of real, it real is the thing that governs, the thing that colonizes, the thing that finally determines. And we know and believe this with all of our hearts. And we hear this earnestness in all kinds of admonitions towards reason and everything else. It's all mind over matter. What's Roger Penrose going to do with this?
What you've just described sounds suspiciously like God, Bill.
Yes, it did sound suspiciously like that, yes.
Roger, what do you say to that?
Well,
I believe! No, he doesn't say that.
You're putting it as an interesting... you're putting it in the mental world, if you like, whereas I tend to put it in the Platonic mathematical world.
Platonism!
You see, that I don't quite see why... I mean, how do you drive the precision? You see, just a mental thing doesn't seem to me, but
and let's give Penrose a little bit of it's really hard in the moment with the cameras on when you hear a new idea, and that was one of the things I really appreciated in my conversation with John Vervaeke, just how honest he is. And I mean, there's so much, there's status and there's all these kind of things riding. And so, okay, back to the conversation, because what Penrose is about to say here really caught my attention. So there was the treasure of the mind-matter-math trilemma, let's say, and then, because what Penrose is about to say really captures, I think, so much of so many, what is lurking behind so much of the listening to my channel that I hear people wrestling with in the comments section on the Discord service and emails to me and conversations I do.
I don't quite see why it helps, if you like. I mean, you can postulate a super mental being or something. I mean, does it have a mental existence without a physical one? Is that the idea?
Yes. Yes, and so this mind, this...
And just what Penrose said there, and I want to go back to it, because I think it's... For so many, when I'm having conversations with you, what Penrose just said there is, I think, exactly what we hear.
I don't quite see why it helps, if you like. I mean...
I don't quite see why it helps. Helps with what?
You can postulate a super mental being.
Again, the word super comes in, and I really should do a words that fudge on supernatural.
Or something. I mean, does it have a mental existence without a physical one? Is that the idea?
And that, of course, is something that hinges on so many of the conversations that the line of disagreement between theists and atheists right now seems to all be about, is mental contingent upon physical? And we don't know exactly how. And as with the panpsychism conversations, we can't even prove yes or no. You know, when I had the little online debate with Shannon, you know, when I brought up the Brett Weinstein tsunami illustration, which I was thinking about doing a video just on that illustration because I think it's such a helpful illustration. Science can't tell you whether or not there's spirit in the water, or whether or not spirit controls the world. And every time there's a tsunami, Christians go into overdrive as to what degree God is or isn't responsible for that. And lately, the current regime is, God doesn't cause that. And when I hear that, I think, wow, that's not what the Heidelberg Catechism says. That's not what seems so often implicit in the Bible. But how and why, and I mean, that's all quite complex, but God is certainly not uninvolved in those kinds of things, if you read the Bible. So what's going on here? So this idea of, can there be mind without a material substrate to create it? In so many ways, that's the line in the ongoing trench warfare right now in our culture.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, and so that some, this mental, this mind, this omniscient mind has created a contingent physical realm and is the source of the conceptual realm as well.
Now, I like to talk about the simulation argument, but I hate the name of it because when I think about this, it isn't really a simulation because a simulation imagines that we're simulating some other thing. But what the simulation argument and the power that it has comes from the idea that when we now have the experience of creating things that are lifelike, we very much imagine and very much see how the realm that we play and interact with in augmented reality or in World of Warcraft or in Call of Duty or in any of these games, this mind, we know it's coming from minds. And so I think intuitively we have a sense of mind creating a world. And we increasingly have the sense that this physical world where when we had just sort of atoms, ta-da, the cell phone stand, when we had just sort of atoms, we thought, well, that's really hard. And now we have this strange world given to us by the science of physics that says there's more space within the atoms. The particles are so much tinier than the space between them, even though that's all tiny, tiny, tiny. And so now we very much have the sense that, well, mind is governing. And that's winning, but that's deeply disturbs the argument that it's physical. And right now, I think in terms of the zeitgeist, these two things are very much competing against one another.
I can't quite see. Well, you could say that it contains all that because it's so infinite that it contains the entire mathematical world.
That would be God, what Christians call God, yes.
In that sense. But does it, where does it come from? What's its...
Well, it would have to be metaphysically necessary in order to be the source of broadly logically necessary mathematical truths, and I would say other sorts of truths, ethical truths that are plausibly necessary.
Yes, it's very curious. You see, you have the mental world sort of being a necessary.
Right.
And I have the mathematical world somehow being a necessity because it's somehow...
Well,
mathematical
truths
somehow. Yes.
And again, I think here object permanence makes our experience of mind feel so contingent upon our biological realm. Yet, well, there's the question. Is mind itself contingent upon it? Or have these things now been with us deeply intertwined? Now, what's interesting is that for many, many years, people have said, well, we're both. We're these strange hybrid creatures that are mind and matter, that we actually govern with rationality. Now we're back into C.S. Lewis's Miracles and how many different classical arguments. And he wants to put math first, but, you know, the math is just sort of out there and it's necessary, but math doesn't make bridges. Math doesn't make skyscrapers. Math doesn't make bombs. Math doesn't grow crops. Math, we very much use math. We employ math. Mind colonizes math and matter to make bridges and buildings and of course the celebrity atheists say, well, that's rationality. Yeah, it is. But mind is governing all of these things. And so
I appreciate the necessity, but the problem is that the abstract realm has no causal powers. These are causally effete objects that never come into contact with things physically. They can't move them or shove them or pull them. They exert no forces. They are not minds, and so they can't make decisions to cause things. They're not causal agents. So it seems to me that positing the abstract realm as fundamental is causally inadequate. And what one would gain from what I'm proposing would be a solution to these three mysteries. It would give explanatory depth to your worldview.
I don't quite see how it explains anything. You're talking from a perspective of a religious person, and therefore one's thinking of this as somehow, I mean, specific religions are much more specific than
right, and that's why I grimaced a bit when you said from a religious perspective. Yes. It's a philosophical perspective, but
okay. It is. I'm happier with that, because then
we're a little skittish of religion, because religion gets all up in our stuff, and religion makes decisions, and religion pins us down, and we don't like that. We so love our freedom, and we so love the idea that we can colonize this world at will and do what we want with it, except for all of these pesky people that don't see things our way.
You see, this is where I have more trouble if one's trying to make it specific in certain directions as regards.
And right there, I think, is the reticence about religion. It's this emotional, we know that it impinges on us, and we so hate that.
I'm happier with that, because then, you see, this is what I have.
Because philosophy is just kind of out there, sort of like math. But religion has gods and judgment and hell and heaven and punishment and reward and ought, and philosophy, well, we can just kind of keep it in the abstract, keep it in the math.
I have more trouble if one's trying to make it specific in certain directions as regards one religion or another. But if it's just such an abstract notion, it's not that I'm necessarily unhappy with it, except that I don't know what to do with it.
Right there. I don't know what to do with it. And this leads me to, well, Peterson's point that we see opportunities and obstacles. And so when religion is an opportunity, it excites us. And when religion is an obstacle, it troubles us. And the thought that there might be a great mind that is the source of all of this, well, that on one hand, as long as we keep it impersonal, like the Force in Star Wars, that gives us a sense of opportunity, because deep inside it, if it's the Force, then we can colonize it. Use the Force, Luke, and we can bend it to our wills. This is the story of Genesis 3. But if it has a will of its own, then we're back to C.S. Lewis talking about pantheism, that, well, it's fun to play. But what happens when we hear footsteps in the hall and we decide that this mind is not just something ultimately available to us to colonize and do as we will, but something which has control over us, or schemes upon us, or obligations under which we must live. And again, all of this is religion. And so he says, well, what do we do with it? If we come to believe that mind, math, and matter are related by a source mind, what then? Does that mind care how we relate back? Are there consequences for our regard for this mind, or our behavior towards this mind or the other minds with which we share this mind verse? Could such a mind be known? And of course, Roger Penrose is exactly right. We're now in the realm of religion. Religion's attempt to address these questions on a massive scale for regular people. Religions, in fact, create worlds in which regular people inhabit and play out their games. And, you know, I haven't forgotten Jordan Peterson. What's the relationship between RR, relevance realization, and Peterson's talking about story verse and Jung and how we relate to these things? Well, in many ways, story is the machine code of our relevance realization in so many ways. Our action and regard matter for some religions more than others, obviously, but expand the frame of present mind consciousness behind the now and always. In a sense, that's what science forces us to do, is forces us to look at the always and the now and the always available and the repeatable. But the problem is that narrative is not this way, and history is not this way. And this is part of the point that Lewis makes, C.S. Lewis makes again and again, that Christianity, very much separate from Islam and Buddhism and many other religions, that Christianity depends on history in a specific way, because Christianity believes that history is revelatory, that history reveals. And this is in some ways the relationship between Christianity and science, let's say, because again, it's a time shift between the always. Now, Christianity obviously talks about the always, but Christianity gets specific, that specific incidents must impact our view of the always, and not just what is always available all the time, such as a list of rules or a worldview of certain operations and mechanisms within that worldview, or even just a world of oughts. Christianity asserts that there are points in time within the narrative that actually illuminate the always. And that's what C.S. Lewis goes into in his great chapter in the book Miracles, and he does it in a variety of other places. You can find it on the C.S. Lewis Doodles as well. The grand miracle, where these events happen with Jesus Christ that are the middle of the symphony or the middle of the book that makes sense on the rest of the book, that it's the light through which everything else falls into place. That's why Lewis says he believes it. But now, of course, contemporary skepticism is armed against this. Someone keeps, I should put the link in here, that Tim McGrew, who teaches in Michigan, has a video course on deism. And deism is an important part of this. And one of the things that comes up in deism is a bias towards the democratic. Now, this both sets up science in this always now linkage of scientific demand, but it also prejudices our view of the world in that everything must be democratic. And again, Lewis takes this on directly in a number of places, because we believe that fairness means history and being is completely available to all of us in the same way, even though we know that history is nothing like that. History is dramatically unfair. The Greeks knew this, but this gets built into our assumptions of the just and the moral and the good, that God must have a democratic, I don't mean that in terms of the Democratic or Republican Party, but a small d, God must have a democratic approach to us. And there are elements of the Bible that talk about it. God is not a respecter of persons, but at the same time, God does seem to play favorites, and God does seem to choose. And in fact, Christ in Greek and Messiah in Hebrew are anointed. And so, as is so often the case in religions, there's a both and-ness, that God is both fair, judging people on with a democratic principle, but God also is not limited to that and can very much play favorites. But there's a fairness in his favoritism, because if you take a look at the people he chooses, he usually chooses them to suffer, for which many people say, oh, please choose someone else. And so there's these dynamics, okay, going on in religion, and this is very much what scares us. Now, I think Western secularity is an implicit amnesiac Christianity, because what you see in all of these assumptions is, as Charles Taylor so nicely points out, the buffered self, how we imagine that all of this stuff goes on and just me and my little self, I'm buffered from this. I think a lot of this is simply experientially and narratively derived from the success of our affluent, controlled civilizations in the 20th and 21st century, that, you know, politics goes on and on, but the lights stay on here in North America. Not so the third world. You don't feel so buffered living in the third world when, you know, the police can haul you in because for any old reason they want. So what in a sense I think we are children sneaking peeks from the monarchical throne, imagining we can see like Father. And that tends to be the view. And so we look around and our estimations of the world. See, the difficulty, Jordan Peterson points this out again and again, thinking scientifically is very hard, and it is not natural to us. And I would assert that, quite rightly, we are far more governed by our intuitions, but of course our biases creep into our intuition. So this is true for all of us. And it's true for William Lane Craig, who's the Christian in the conversation, and it's true for Roger Penrose, who is the, let's just call him an agnostic, a decline to choose. But for an ancient person, this declining to choose would simply be unthinkable, because it would be like saying, well, I'm indifferent to gravity. I'm, you know, some people believe in it, but I'm not sure I do, so I'm indifferent to it. And it's like, well, you know, every time you go down the stairs, you're kind of acting as if gravity is real. So we must use our intuition, but of course it's motivated and biased, and how could it not be? But that's the lot we are stuck with: right and left brained, mapped and unmapped worlds, and trying to figure them out. So We're stuck with being the small-brained creature that we are. Now, of course, a religion like Christianity asserts that things have happened in history which shed light on, the way of the world and the truth of the world, and those things are not necessarily as available to anyone at any given time and place. Now, there's a certain implicit trick that goes on with science. Let's say, well, they've used a super collider to learn some things about physics. And you say, well, if you would set up another super collider, you would learn the same thing if you would repeat the experiment. That's in fact the basis of scientific examination, but we don't repeat the experiment. And so in many ways, science is also based on history, but availability. And this is, again, where persons are frustrating for science, because we're so fickle and we're so unavailable. The Paul van der Klee at 5:08 October 8, 2019, Tuesday, where it's 78 degrees in his office, that Paul is about to go, and it'll be the Paul of 5:09. And it'll be the Paul of 5:10, and it'll be hopefully the Paul of tomorrow, and on and on and on and on we go. So, but I think what we're living in is what, again, I say, a Western secularity as implicit amnesiac Christianity. I've been listening to a lot of Rene Girard, and I really want to dig into his books. Someone on Twitter today said I need to start reading up on critical theory, and it's like, it's not at the top of my salience hierarchy right now. I'm much more interested in Rene Girard, because he's noting some different things, and so far the resource that I'm using are these conversations that he did with David Cayley, and there you can find them on YouTube. They were on Canadian on CBC. Boy, you Canadians, you got such good stuff on TV. We Americans, we make TV for the world to watch, but you got all these brainy people in Canada. It must be the cold. You had nothing else to do but think up there in the frozen north, I suppose. But so if you're looking for it in book form, you can find it in The Ideas of Rene Girard, edited by David Cayley, or you can find it on YouTube. And I just want to play a little clip of this, because what I find again and again with... when I listen to Sam Harris talk to Jordan Peterson, or when I listen to Brett Weinstein and the implicit morality and ethics, you know, at least Adam has it right in acknowledging that the ethical world in which we live, the implicit ethical standards that we use to operate, are delivered to us from Christianity. This is the ruler that we use, but we've somehow rubbed Jesus' name off the ruler, and we say, oh, here's this ruler. It's been with us forever. And again, if you read the sociologist Christian Smith, he in all of his studying of the ruler that teenagers use to measure the world, they just say, well, this ruler is self-evident. It fell from the sky, or it's always right. And no one says, well, is your ruler historically conditioned? And René Girard lays this down quite nicely, I think.
But in discussions between Muslims and Christians, it goes without saying that you will never talk about that. Because in these discussions, we take Christian ethics to be the absolute value. It's a modern value.
And this, what he makes this comment here, I clipped out a bunch of it, where he's talking about Christian and Muslim conversations. And Christians are secular people, Western people, Sam Harris, Ben Affleck. These are all people judging Muslims by Christian standards. Now, of course, Muslims recognize this because they understand religion a lot better than a whole secular world that's in sort of this uneasy denial about, well, don't ask us where we get our ethical system from. The Muslims understand, well, you're trying to make us Christians. No. I just don't want you to be violent. Well, what's wrong with violence? In fact, most of human history would say, what's wrong with violence? And we say, oh, no, violence is wrong, except when we think it's justifiable for when we, I don't know, bomb other nations and do things like that. But other than that, violence is wrong. We can all agree on that. And so it's Hobbes, you know, the state having a monopoly on violence and all of this stuff that we just say, well, this ethic is just self-evident, like a teenager interviewed from Christian Smith. But René Girard is not fooled.
And it doesn't come from Christianity. It's
so we think
the natural way to be for us. And when the people complain about the violence that came from Christianity, they are right. But they are throwing back at Christian values, not their own. They can complain because they have Christianity to complain with.
I love that line. They can complain because they have Christianity to complain with. And every time you hear Sam Harris launching off about the Bible, he's using Christianity against the Bible. And when you hear Brett Weinstein talk about this new religion that we need to have, he's got Christianity and he's using that. In fact, Christianity has so won the day that we use Christianity to complain about Christianity. And in fact, the critical theory people, that's what they're doing.
From what point of view, otherwise, could they blame Christianity? They can complain because they have Christianity to complain with. From what point of view, otherwise, could they blame Christianity? We don't radicalize things enough. We take for granted certain aspects of Christian ethics as if they had been the norm. If you had gone to a Roman functionary...
I'm really anticipating Tom Holland's Dominion book, because that's what this is all about, the point he's about to make.
Norm. If you had gone to a Roman functionary, and if you had said, I'm a victim of your system, you owe me some kind of compensation, he would have been so amazed, you know, and... he would say, you deserve to die for saying that. What right do you have? Are you a Roman citizen? No. To the scaffold or to the wild beasts. We don't see the world as it is, you know, as it was. And in a way, it still is. We always turn against Christianity, the foothold into nonviolence that it gave us. Where would it come from before?
Condemning Christianity's failures while taking its achievement for granted leads, in Girard's view, to an upside-down view of history. We read the record of Western civilization as a violent sequence of crusades, inquisitions, and colonial conquests, but we often overlook the violence of the cultures that were overcome by the West. Gerard?
Sometimes when I go to Canada, home of you smart people, and someone, I saw this in a denominational meeting, someone is naming the indigenous people tribe that held that land when the Europeans came over and took it from them. Well, fair enough. But that indigenous tribe that held the land when the Europeans took it from them, they didn't spring out of the ground. They quite likely took it from another group who is forgotten because they kept no record and didn't think there was any reason to keep a record, and took it from another group 15,000 years ago by a land bridge, right? So they kept taking it from other groups, but only our culture imagines we should feel a little guilty about taking it from the other group. And yeah, rightly so, fair enough. But we're using Christianity to say, oh, those Christians and the age of the document of discovery, I forget what it's called.
It gives, as an example, the institution of potlatch, a feast involving competitive gift-giving and the destruction of wealth that was practiced among the tribes of the Pacific coast of North America.
At some point, the Canadian government banned potlatch.
Those terrible people. Canadian government. Bah!
And if you look at the documents, you realize that they banned potlatch for an extremely good reason. It was a tremendous destruction of wealth, in particular blankets, you know, or things like that, which was a dreadful thing. Potlatch is as bad as anorexia and bulimia, you know. It's destruction which ultimately is for the prestige of the two or three chiefs who are fighting about who will destroy the greatest quantity of goods. Now, think about Canadian people in the 19th century, rationalists and so forth. They felt it was their duty to forbid such an institution. Can you blame them for that?
Girard argues that we should try to understand why people acted as they did in the past, rather than blaming them. He says this, I think, not to excuse evil acts, but to point up a prevalent form of scapegoating. Blaming our ancestors always implies the claim that we would have done better in their shoes. It's a way of protesting our eternal innocence and brightening our self-esteem. And this is what he objects to. Otherwise, he says, he has no wish to try to justify the terrible and undeniable suffering of which Western civilization has been the cause.
I have absolutely no right, you know, to say this is worth that and you can pile up suffering that high in order. I don't want to do that. I just say I'm a Christian. I believe that it's all for the good. But it's only faith. I don't want to justify it. I can justify it with all sorts of arguments, but they are no good. Because when it's real suffering, you have to remain silent.
A rush to judgment, René Girard says, is characteristic of our time. And by this excessively critical spirit, he says, we too easily put ourselves above the world.
I think what is lacking in an attitude which is too negative is gratitude. You know, one of the things in Judeo-Christian tradition, which is tremendously important, is the praise of God. And that's what we seem to be unable to do in the modern world. We are all rebellion. And we are self-righteous rebellion because you say we are better than this history. We would do better if we were in the place of God. That's all it means.
So we're not only crawling up into the throne of God to get a peek at the monarchical vision, we're crawling up into the throne of God to judge God. And, well, so what if William Lane Craig is right? What if this is true? We always express our implicit worldviews. We always work them out. And these three realms, what if mind is the way that the three come together? And well, because our minds are so temporary, our minds have this beginning. C.S. Lewis asserts, and I agree with him, that, and so does Kierkegaard, that what if, in fact, our story goes on? and our mind doesn't stop with our life or the physical. What if, in fact, as the majority of human beings who have ever lived, what if we go on from our mind, with our mind beyond our bodies? What then? Well, at that point, we might want to think about religion, and we might want to think. Now, this, again, gets very interesting if you look again at the nuns and the duns with the Nathan Jacobs stuff that I did. And Nathan and I, hopefully, will talk again. He's pretty busy right now. But one of the things that bothers the nuns and the duns is life after death, because many suspect it's true, and they're uncertain of what would happen. But, oh, what if we have to go back into religion? What then? What will that do?